Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Welcome to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, your host on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And I got to thank some genies because this past week I went and posted an old photograph from the 1920s. It was my dad as a young guy with his parents sitting on a park bench in a park. And behind them was my grandfather's old jalopy, the old car. And I have no idea what kind it was. So I posted it and asked some genies to come through and tell me what year, make, and model that car was. And it didn't take but a couple of hours, but Anne Elizabeth Wilder and Janice Lutenberg Simpson came through and said, that's a 1926 Buick Coupe. Very impressive. So now I'm trying to actually find somebody who owns one so I can take a spin in what my grandfather used to run around in. Unbelievable. Well, later on in the show, we're going to talk to a lady who is the head of a genealogical society and found out a while back that she is actually the descendant of a family of slaves that were sold by Jesuit priests that ran a college back in the 1830s. They sold these slaves among 270 people to the auction block in New Orleans to raise money to keep that college from going broke. Today, that college is still around. It's known as Georgetown University. You're going to want to hear this story with Pat Bayonne Johnson from Spokane, Washington, coming up in about 7 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Unbelievable. But right now, let's check in with my good friend David Allen Lambert, back from his London trip, getting ready to go on the road again here, actually, very soon. David, how are things in Beantown today?
They're doing good. Just touching my feet down before I leave next week for the NGS conference where I'm speaking in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Well, I'll tell you, it was a wonderful trip to Europe. I had a wonderful time. It was genealogy, sightseeing, sore feet, the whole thing all wrapped up into one.
Yep, and you sent us all kinds of great stuff back that we're posting on Facebook, so check it out, and Twitter.
Well, some exciting news for a family. The Underdahl family is now welcoming a little girl into the family for the first time in 100 years.
What?
Apparently this family predominantly produces boys. So for the first time since this little girl's great-great-aunt was born back in 1914, there has been no females in the family. She's got a beautiful name, Aurelia Marie Ann Underdahl. So welcome to the world. Hopefully she'll be one of many happy little girls born into that family, and they don't have to wait another 101 years.
That's crazy.
She got a very interesting name, but, you know, if you look at society today, you know, sometimes people have a lot of trouble naming children. I mean, I told you the story. I'm named for Davy Jones of the Monkees, which is a story in its own right. But there's a company in Switzerland which for $29,000, they will help you name your child.
Really? Wait a minute. You would pay $29,000 to a company to help you name your child with a name we can't even pronounce?
I was taking a good stab at it myself. Yeah. Well, I always say buy American, so the company will do the same thing for a few hundred dollars. I wonder if the process of just putting names in a hat still works.
Wow.
Maybe that's what the glorified price tag is. Maybe it's a really nice Stetson or something. Now, I'll tell you, with families, it's always great to, you know, take pictures, but sometimes they can get lost because of moving or fire or whatever. There's a person by the name of Ollie Lansley in England who had something very interesting when they bought a second-hand sofa armchair at a furniture sale in South London. They found a photo album in the sofa. They were able to return it to Neil Douglas because he lost it 20 years ago during a family move.
It was stuffed in the cushions then. Unbelievable.
Apparently, yeah. I'm glad to think that somebody didn't think, just throw this out. This is a piece of junk. That they went to the effort to post it online and somebody found it. You know, when I was traveling in Europe, I probably could have used this. There's a t-shirt which has 40 universal icons for bathroom, for water, for a hospital, and it's going viral with people purchasing these. It would have come handy for me for my limited French when I was in Paris, but I bumped around okay. But if you go to a country where you can't speak the language, this simple t-shirt will allow you to point to something on it and maybe get the help you need with
Wow.
the universal icon.
I love the sound of that. What a great idea.
Yeah, I'm going to have to put it on my bucket list for the holidays, if my family ever lets me leave the country again.
Yeah.
With any HGS, I always try to give you out a tech tip. And one of the things, that obviously, we were getting close to the end of the year. How about thinking about how excited you were about when you left school? Well, how about finding the records when you did go to school? For me, I tracked down my grandmother's report cards from when she graduated in 1914 a few years back. How about you? Have you ever got your parents' old school records or report cards?
I've got my mom's report cards from the 20s and 30s. I've got my own, but I don't have my dad's. This is a great idea. He graduated high school in 1931 in New Jersey, so I'm going to have to see if they've got those. That would be amazing.
It would. And, you know, some schools still retain them, so you might be able to get, I mean, in the digital age, they could probably scan them and send them to you if you prove that you're related to the person. And I got to find out that my grandmother's math grades were no better than mine, even though she rode me on the rail many times over my math grades. So shame she wasn't alive when I got them. The NEHGS has our free database. This includes Dominican Republic baptisms, marriages, and deaths that span the 17th century right down to the early 20th century. And this is in conjunction with our partnership with FamilySearch.org. Over 90,000 baptisms, 10,000 deaths, and 60,000 marriages. I hope to see some people down in NGS in Florida. I'd like to meet some new Extreme Genes listeners stateside.
All right, David. Great to talk to you. Have a safe trip. We'll talk to you from Florida next week.
Well, you sure will. Talk to you then.
All right. And, you know, sometimes when you find an ancestor, you often find a story behind that person that's just a shocker. And that's certainly the case with my next guest. Hi, it's Fisher, and you're back with Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. And on the line with me right now from Spokane, Washington, the president of the Eastern Washington Genealogical Society, Pat Bayonne Johnson. Hi, Pat. Welcome to Extreme Genes.
Hi, Scott. Thank you. Happy to be here.
You know, I was reading in the New York Times about this incredible story about a university that we're all really familiar with, Georgetown University. I mean, every year, of course, we see them in the NCAA tournament. They have a great heritage. But if you go back far enough, you'll find that they almost went away at one point. And as a result of that, they took extreme measures to make sure that their debts were paid. And this involved at least one of your ancestors, Pat. Tell us the story and give us some of the background on this.
Well, it involves an entire family whose last name was Butler. And in 1838, they were enslaved on the St. Inigo Plantation, which is owned and operated by the Jesuits. And they were also sold in 1838. The Jesuits are getting out of the slave business for a number of reasons, mostly economic, and decided to sell the slaves to large plantation owners. The slaves were purchased for Jesse Beatty. The actual purchaser was a former governor, Henry Johnson.
What was he governor of, Pat?
Of Louisiana, Missouri. Yes.
Okay.
I'm originally from Louisiana, from New Orleans.
Okay.
And so the slaves were sold on behalf of Henry Beatty, but Henry Johnson made the purchases. They ended up on a plantation in Louisiana in Bayou, Maryland, and they were discovered in 2004 when we were planning for a family reunion.
So you made the discovery that your ancestor had been among this group of slaves. Now it was like over 230 of them, correct?
Well, the number that the Jesuits provide is 272.
So the Jesuit priests, they ran Georgetown University. It was a college at the time in Washington, D.C. And as I understand it, the Jesuit priests actually tried to get it cleared through Rome, those people who oversaw their institution. And they said, well, there are going to be certain guidelines here. And apparently these local priests did not follow those guidelines in selling them to basically the auction block in New Orleans and shipped them off. There's one story there of one of the priests who disapproved of this entirely, describing one woman on the docks being loaded into the ships, begging and asking, what have I done to deserve this? And being shipped off to New Orleans. I mean, what a tragic story.
This is very moving.
And so when you discovered this, how did this hit you?
Well, it was quite a shock. We are a big family of Louisiana Roman Catholics, and we have a lot of devoted Catholics in my family, and we never heard anything about the Catholics being involved in slavery.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't either.
Didn't entertain the idea. So, to say the very least, it was appalling.
Yeah, and I would imagine that it was a faith shaker for some people in your family, yes?
Oh, yes, definitely. But, you know, eventually, I think they put it aside and they got over it. No one has left the faith because of it.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who have left the faith not because of that, but we have not had people to leave Catholicism because of a Jesuit leave.
Now, you mentioned that this was one family in your line. How many members were there that were shipped down to New Orleans from Washington?
From Washington, there was, Nathan D.B. Butler, and I think 11 children.
Wow.
Well, actually, there were 13 children. Two of them were separated from the rest of them.
And sold off to someplace separate.
I think they went to another plantation. When we find them on the manifest, and this would be Bridget and Susan, or Suki as she was called, they were listed as being on their own. And all the other family members were together, you know, on the manifest.
Sure.
So you have, I think it was 11 children plus Nathan B.B. Butler, and then you have these two daughters on their own, separate from the group on the manifest.
So when you're talking about having a big family reunion, you're talking about descendants of this particular group of 13.
Yes. Right. The descendants of that particular 13 people.
Now, how many descendants are there today, would you say?
I come from a big family. My grandfather had 8 children, and 6 of those 8 half-children. So there are many. I mean, I've never counted them.
Right, and you're just going back 2 generations. I mean, there have got to be hundreds more when you go back that far, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. The slaves that were discovered in 2004 were my third great-grandparents. So my third great-grandparents gave birth to my second great-grandmother, and her name is Mary Butler. And Mary had a daughter who's my first great-grandmother named Rachel. Rachel married a man named Hicks, James Henry Hicks, and Rachel gave birth to my grandfather, who is Mace Hicks. So the name has traveled from 1838 until Mace Hicks. The name Mace has been passed through my family for generations, and we didn't know anything about it until we discovered them in 2004.
Now, that's almost like your own root story, isn't it?
It is my own root story.
You know, yeah.
And Mace Hicks, my grandfather, he only had one son. He named his son Mace. And so Mace Jr. named his first son Mace. And then Mace Jr. also had another son who he did name Mace, but he used it as a middle name.
Right. So we've seen it's almost the Kunta Kinte thing, right? Passed all the way through.
It definitely feels that way.
Yeah.
It definitely feels
yeah.
that way.
Well, you being a genealogist, that's probably one of the reasons that you've been so out in front of this, because really this story is only starting to break right now in the last several months. And many
yeah.
people looking at this and going, now, wait a minute, we have several big things going on here. We have the Catholic Church involved in slavery. We have a major institution that still thrives to this day, Georgetown University, that would have gone bankrupt had it not been for the sale of all these people to the auction block in New Orleans back in 1838. So even though it was so long ago, the ripples are still having a major effect, and a lot of people are now wanting to get a hold of all the descendants, and I guess what essentially amounts to a descendants organization. Yes, Pat?
Yes, the Georgetown Memory Project was established in November 2015. I was contacted by Richard Cellini, who's, you know, a mover and shaker in that organization. And at first he was just looking for a descendant. And he found me. He talked to me and I asked him, why do you want to know this? Why do you want to research my ancestors? And he said he wanted to find a descendant. He has association with the university. He has 2 degrees from Georgetown. And throughout those years, he has heard that there were no survivors of 272 slaves that were shipped to Louisiana. And I guess he set out to prove them wrong.
Yeah. That's kind of a curious thing, isn't it? Really?
Yes, it is. And so he, you know, and after he contacted me, and I was willing to work with him, the Georgetown Men's Group was formed soon after that. From my blog, he also discovered that Judy Rifford was the person who I had hired to help me in my search for my family for a family reunion.
Sure.
Not knowing any of this other stuff was going to be there. And I highly recommend her because I have used her, I've hired her before, and she's found lots of good information for me. So he hired her to find a descendant of the 272, and I would work toward that effort also, but I wanted to research my line. And so,
and get to know them.
My line is the Butler line.
Yeah.
And I see my line has spilled over. You know, those 272 slaves, because they were shipped and many of them ended up on the same plantation, they married each other.
So sometimes you wind up going back into the same lines, right?
Oh, yeah. We just 15 people in total. It has blossomed into at least 200 to 300. We haven't added it up because there was a lot of intermarrying between the slaves.
Sure, sure.
And the slaves had children, and the children have had children. As I said, my grandfather had 8 children, and most of them had children. So there are a lot of descendants, and we're just one line. So I can imagine that the other lines have just as many or more.
Wow. It's just an incredible story, and I'm sure it's just all coming to life with you right now with so many other people getting involved in the story and other descendants coming forward. You know, this is not unusual. For instance, there was the General Slocum steamboat disaster in New York City at the beginning of the 20th century, and I think it was like 1,500 people died in that, and there's still organizations of descendants to remember those people from that experience. And so this sounds like a fantastic project to honor your people who went through a horrendous situation, but have given you, you know, a new life in Louisiana as a result. I mean, that's part of who you are.
Yes. I've never forgotten my roots.
No.
Even though I've spent more time in California. I lived in California from 1964 until 2004, which is when we moved to Spokane. So I spent 40 years there as opposed to 21 years in Louisiana.
And Pat, there's now this effort to find as many descendants as possible from all these slaves that were sold down to New Orleans. What is happening with that? There's been talk of perhaps giving some of the descendants free tuition to attend or something along these lines, or trying to figure out something that can be done, not only to honor these people, but to make some kind of reparation.
Yes. You know, when I started this journey in 2004, my main goal was to just tell my family story. That's all I wanted. I've never had goals of reparation or apologies or any of those things. And I'm not saying those are not valid. But that was never my goal. I just wanted to tell my story.
To a great extent, I think that's the most important part in honoring and remembering these people, because they made a great sacrifice on behalf of everybody who descends from them today.
Yes, you know, just telling their story, because it's not taught in schools, is hidden. The history is there. It just needs to be found and brought to light.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that I was a member of the African American Genealogical Society of Northern California. In our society, we have this saying, it's your history. Isn't it time you tell your story? And when I joined that organization way back, I think probably around 2002, I just took that to heart. That is all I've ever wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do people deserve reparations for their suffering? Yes. It's not my issue, but yes. I think something is due. You think scholarship's a good idea?
Yeah, it's challenging to figure out exactly how do you compensate for something that happened to so many people so long ago. It's a difficult issue, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes. How do you go about doing something like that? I'm finding my family, it's a very tangled web.
Yeah.
Finding all of the descendants is going to be a major task in itself. And we don't know how the descendants are going to take this news. There are many people who don't know that they're descendants of the Jesuit slaves. There are many, many people.
Now, have you had contact with people who descended from some of the other slaves that were involved in this?
No, I have not. There are not that many people who've been contacted. I think Maxine Crump is one, and there's a few others. We don't quite know how we're going to do that just yet. Initially, the project was supposed to begin with the 1870 and then go back, but we eventually hope to go forward also. But we don't know how we're going to do that yet.
Yeah, it's very complicated, isn't it?
We don't know how receptive people are going to be.
So do you ever envision the time where perhaps all the different descendants get together for one huge reunion of all of the people who were shipped to New Orleans from Georgetown?
That would be wonderful.
So tell me, have you discovered anything further about the ancestors, some stories that existed or where they were sent off to? What about the plantations? What were the plantation owners like? How are they treated? What have you learned?
For the most part, I really don't know how they were treated on the plantations. We're still kind of at the beginning of the research because it's just started in November, but we are finding the plantation owners. Initially, when I did the research, I just had the four records that Judy Riffel found, and one of them was an 1851 inventory of the late Jesse Beatty, and that was then all my ancestors were there, the ones that were sold to him, and they were mentioned by name, color, age, and their value, you know, in terms of dollars.
Right.
And then I think the document that she found was when the heirs of Jesse Beatty sold them to the Barrels, and when the Barrels sold them to the Wool folks, you know, so forth and on. And the last document that Judy found was the 1838 bill of sale from Thomas Mullady to Jesse Beatty in 1838. We can now fill in those blanks, 1838 to the 1851, 53, you know, whatever.
Right,
you know.
Moving forward.
We kind of have a complete record. It is a lot of information to process.
I bet.
And, you know, the bulk of the records have been found since November. I haven't really had a chance to go into the plantation records. I do have copies of those. I do have the inventories. We have newspaper articles. But it's a lot of information. I just have not studied any one plantation in great detail.
Now, how many documents were actually found at Georgetown?
We found the 1838 bill of sale. I took all this information because, remember, we're preparing for a family reunion. I sent all this information to my aunt in New York, and she was going to write the story. And I didn't process the information at all. The stuff that I got from Judy, I just sent right on to
right.
her. And she's the one that plugged in Thomas Mullady's name. And that's when we found out that Thomas Mullady was a Jesuit priest. And then also she discovered the document, which is called the Jesuit Plantation Project. And those documents consist of an inventory of the slaves. They list them by the plantations they were on. There were four plantations. They gave the profiles of the slaves, the age, the name,
right.
whether they were deceased or not. Also included was a ship manifest. And the ship manifest lists the slaves by name, of course, and which ship they were put on to go to Louisiana. My family was on ship number 2. I set out to find the name of the ship that my ancestors were on. And then there was also a diary of Brother Moberly, I think it's not how you would pronounce his name, or Father Moberly, how you would pronounce his name.
Right.
And he had spent some time on a couple of the plantations, but it seems to be mostly the one where my family was, which is St. Inigo's. And there was also a bibliography of all the resources, you know, pertaining to the Jesuit slaveholding. So I copied that document, and it amounts to about an inch thick of paper. And later on, that document that I copied proved to be the only document available because they have since taken it down. They took it down.
Too controversial?
I have no idea. I understand. Maybe now when I was first contacted, I was told that it had been down about, removed about 6 months. So it's been more than that. It's another, what? We've been working on this since November. It was down in November.
So let me ask you this. Pat. Is this a joyous project at this point or a sad project?
Oh, no way. It's not a sad project at all. We just, I guess if you could see me, I talk with my hands. I don't want to take all the credit, and I really do want to give the names of my butler team.
Sure.
Here in Spokane. We have Barbara Brazington. We have Dolly Webb, Mary Holcomb, Carol Anderson, Juanita McBride, Pat Ayers, and one other person, and her name is Jeanette Birch. So that's my team.
Wow. Well, what a team.
People.
And what a story, and it's going to go on for a long, long time. Pat Bayonne-Johnson, thank you so much for your time and sharing your ancestors' story. And it's a fascinating thing with a lot of different facets to it.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to tell my story.
And coming up next, Tom Perry, our Preservation Authority, talking about ways to preserve your family heirlooms. It is preservation time at Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. Tom Perry is here, our Preservation Authority. Hi, Tommy. How are you?
Hello, super duper.
You know, last week we were talking about some programs that people can use that's cheap and easy to use. You can use for PC and for Mac.
It's like a lot of the other things. It's not really hard to do. It's just there's a learning curve to it.
Sure.
And once you get the hang of it or have your grandkids help you out with it, it's actually kind of fun to do, to kind of go and play with your colors, and it'll blow your mind, just like when we did the film for you years and years ago, when you saw the colors come out so much brighter and vivid. You can do that with even your old VHS tapes. It's amazing.
So I don't have to pay you anymore to correct my color?
Nope, you can do it yourself.
If I'd just waited a little bit, oh.
You could have saved $60. But, you know, that's what this whole thing's about. I mean, I love doing this radio show, and I don't care if anybody ever brings us anything ever again. I want to teach people how to do this kind of stuff. If you got a local guy that works with you, that's what you should be doing. You should support your local people. But if you're in some place where you can't find anybody, and we've talked about what questions to ask, ask the right questions. We're happy to help you. Even if you just email us questions, I'm happy to answer your questions. You can call us on the phone. You can send us stuff. But whatever you can do yourself, do it yourself. Just get your stuff digitized. Get your stuff done. You need to save this stuff. Like you've mentioned before, when somebody dies, it's like a library burned up, and we need to take care of these things.
Well, you know, it's funny. The other day I came home, and my wife was up in a closet and pulling all this stuff down, boxes out. And I said, what are you doing? She said, well, it's about time we got all these things digitized. You and Tom have been talking about this for so long. And so now we have these two huge boxes of VHS and the smaller videos and the cameras that went with them as well. And we tried to watch some of them, and they look pretty good. Then she said to me, oh, I'm so relieved that we're going to get this done. And I said, oh, no, honey. No, we're going to get this started. That's
exactly
all this is you get going on it, because it's going to be a lot of work over a lot of time to just save the different segments that really matter and get rid of the junk so the stuff becomes usable. Now, with this program, does it have a way for you to do titles on it?
Yeah. In fact, that's one thing that's really important. We have a lot of people that bring us in film and video that want music added to it. And, you know, back in the 60s and 70s when we were doing VHS transfers from film, you know, we added music. But we have people that come in that say, can you please remove this music because it doesn't fit the scene? You could have like a funeral scene and you have pop music playing, or you can have fireworks going off and it sounds like some sad symphony of somebody just passed away. So music is okay to add. It's just kind of a background type thing. But what you want to do, you want to go in and narrate them. That's more important. And even if you have old segments of audio tapes, whether they're cassettes, reel-to-reels, and sometimes they may not match the scene exactly, but you put this in so they can hear a great-grandfather talking about things. You can go in and do your own narration. And the neat thing about multi-tracking is you can go and put different things on different tracks. So if somebody wants to listen to the narration, they can listen to the right channel. If they want to listen to Grandma and Grandpa talking, they can listen to the left channel. Just like if you bought the new Star Wars DVD that just came out that has all the things where you can go and hear the director talking about the scenes, you can do that kind of stuff where
wow.
You can hear the basic. It's amazing what you can do. And the neat thing is this software is so easy to use. You can go in and do all kinds of titles. You can do the crawls, which goes across the bottom of the screen like on Fox News, or you can do the rolls like you see at the end of a movie type thing.
Oh, I could think of all kinds of things you could do with that. Grandpa's lying here. He actually did this.
Oh, it's great. It's fun. You can put titles anytime, and sometimes they add a lot of character to it. Sometimes they're just funny because maybe there's a cute thing you know about Grandpa that everybody else doesn't know, and they make it so funny. If you want to put titles over video and there's a lot of colors, you think, well, what did I do? Do I use a light color or dark color? Well, what you want to do is pick a color that you like that's pleasing, but use a drop shadow. So the drop shadow kind of set the title out. So whether it's white in the background or black in the background, as the video's moving past, you'll still be able to see it okay, because the shadow kind of separates the type from the background.
And so that's a simple thing to do.
It's really, really easy. In fact, you can actually go in and animate your text. You can go in and set up motion paths, and you can make your text follow these motion paths. I mean, you can get as creative as you want to, and it is so much fun when you're doing this kind of stuff yourself. It's like walking into the old TV production studios of the old days. You have your main screen that is what you're recording, and you can have all these other clips on all these other windows, so you're seeing a whole bunch of clips. You're not having to go and click through different things. The technology in just the last few years has just been so good for the consumer that they can do so many things at home now that before we couldn't even dream about doing at home. Okay, so what you want to do after you get all your titles put in the right place, then the most important thing, which I talk about all the time, is what's your end user? Is your end user family? You want to put it on YouTube? What do you want to do with it?
It's always the question of who's your audience. You got to know who they are. If you're going to do it for children, it's obvious that you're going to do something entirely different than for adults.
Exactly. And the thing that you mentioned before, sometimes you're going to do things for different members of the family. Like some of your cousins will be uninterested in these things. And that's what's neat about DaVinci Resolve. You can go and set up different timelines for different people and different audio tracks for different people. You can get as specific as you want or as widespread as you want to make different ones for the kids, for the aunts, for the uncles.
You use the same content basically to make several different versions of it for the different audiences.
Exactly. Like if you remember the old days, like 8-track tapes, basically what an 8-track tape is exactly what it sounds. There were 8 lines of audio on it. So you could listen to track 1 or 2 all the way through 8. It's the same thing. You have all these different levels of not only audio, but video. So you have all your video clips. When you're putting it together, you know what your end use is. So you put everything that the cousins are going to want on this line. You put everything that everybody else is going to want on this line. And just make up your different lines. And then when you go and make your final DVD or Blu-ray or however you're going to do it, or QuickTime movie, which are nice, or MP4s, then you just click and run line 1. Then you go back and run line 2. Then you go back, run line 3. And then you can run all the lines together. So everybody's got what everybody wants. It makes it so sweet and easy.
I cannot wait to download this and try it, because you're digitizing all my stuff right now. So I'm ready to learn.
Great. It's awesome.
Hey, thanks, Tom. That's it for this week. Thanks once again to Pat Bayon Johnson from Spokane, Washington, for talking to us about the sale of her ancestors by Jesuit priests from what is today Georgetown University, and how the sale of those ancestors actually saved the university. Incredible story. If you missed it, catch the podcast. Talk to you again next week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org. This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.